crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuchtigal. Of course, we are coming to you from Jerusalem, Israel. If you'd like to send us some feedback, you can do that by sending emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il, and that will reach me, and I'll do my best to respond to you if you have any questions about the programming, or if you just have some comments that you would like to give to us. I'll hopefully get to some of those comments later on in today's show. Well, during the week, a number of you emailed to ask how the tour went that I talked about last week. The tour was going to be with Melanie Phillips, an acclaimed British journalist that currently has a column for The Times. She also has a blog, melaniephillips.com, where a lot of what she writes and what she's thinking does get put online, and a lot of that material doesn't make it into The Times. So if you want more from Melanie Phillips, you could go there. I'll just give her a plug, I guess, at the start of my show. Well, last week I did get to tour her last Sunday. We started our tour around 1 p.m. just inside the Dung Gate of Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem. And really, just the second time meeting her, I tried to kind of play it cool. but she was very welcoming and very easy to talk to. And really, she was just there to listen and learn. She's definitely someone who does want to get the facts. The motto of her blog is actually going wherever the evidence leads. And it was my purpose really for allowing her or giving her the tour was to show her just how much evidence there is already discovered in Jerusalem relating to the periods of King David and King Solomon 3,000 years ago. And we'll even talk a little bit about that today in the second part of today's show. Well, from just the Dung Gate, we walk down to the Davidson Center. That is the tourist center that runs this archaeological park at the southern wall of the Temple Mount. It's a huge archaeological park, a lot of remains from different periods, going from the different Arab periods through the Byzantine period, down to through the Roman period and into the periods before then. But this thing that they have on show right now inside their structure, before you go outside and look at the other remains, is the Hezekiah Bulla. This was the Hezekiah Bulla that was discovered or unearthed back in 2009 and then discovered really exactly what it said, or released to the public directly what it said back in 2015, to show that it was actually King Hezekiah himself from the Judean king. And we looked, you can see that it's on display there. It's a little bit difficult to make out in their display. And I guess if I was going to display King Hezekiah's bulla, the first time that a Judean king has ever been discovered or his name in a controlled scientific excavation, I would probably have absolutely huge banners, noise, make some trumpet blasts. I don't know, trying to get some people's attention to come and see this, because we were the only ones there. We were the only ones there looking at this that seal impression with Hezekiah's imprint, his signature, right there for us to see. And we kind of bemoan the fact that Melanie Phillips did, that we were the only one there when this history goes back 2,700 years. The Bible writes about a king, King Hezekiah, and he, you know, what he did and the his life experience as related to the Assyrian Empire that was coming down to destroy Judah. The pages of the Bible come alive through Hezekiah's time. And there is his signature right there at the Davidson Center, right there in this archaeological park. And there wasn't many people looking at it. That is a shame. That is a big shame. I do believe that the Israeli Museum is due to get this seal impression in the next 3 months. So I hope that they really do draw attention to just how important it is, this discovery. So after looking at that for, 15, 20 minutes, we walked through the archaeological park down to where the Ophel excavations are being conducted. where we've worked over the past few years. And that's kind of the furthest reaches of the archaeological park, which is a really big shame because you have to walk for about a quarter mile to actually get to the place where you find remains from the first temple period, from King Solomon's time, to be precise. You have to go through a lot of the previous periods and walk all the way to the far end to get to see these remains. And again, not many signs. Again, not many big arrows pointing to, hey, King Solomon has been discovered, or things that belonging to King Solomon's rule have been discovered over here. Come see them. No, there was nothing like that. We basically had to get there. And then the signage is pretty good once you arrive there. At the far end of this archaeological park. Well, as we were walking through, I introduced her and a couple of people that she brought with her, some of her friends, really nice people that made Aliyah a couple of years ago from Britain. And they had lots of questions throughout, which I thought was just wonderful. But as we were going through, I talked about the history of the archaeological park there. And this was known as, the excavations that led to this archaeological park was known as the Big Dig, that started back in 1968-1969 with Professor Benjamin Mazar of Hebrew University and with Herbert W. Armstrong of Ambassador College from the United States. And right now, Herbert W. Armstrong College, the where I teach, we are trying to continue this legacy of Mr. Armstrong, who has since died, but who did believe in the history of Jerusalem and the future of Jerusalem as well, and thought it was important to excavate and uncover that history for the world to see. So back in 1967, when Israel won the Six-Day War, and finally they get this territory, a really sacred territory to them, of the Old City, and the area just south of the Temple Mount, they begin excavations there. And they got the help, Hebrew University did, of Ambassador College, led by Mr. Armstrong, back in 1968-1969. And it's interesting because I recently had a discussion with Dr. Joseph Avaram, and he was around with Dr. Benjamin Mazar. He was the head of the Israel Exploration Society. Dr. Joseph Avaram is. He's over 100 years of age and still alive right now. And I had a conversation with him maybe 2 months ago, and he talked about how this partnership between Mr. Armstrong and Hebrew University came about, and talked about the time that Mr. Armstrong in late 1968 came to Jerusalem, flew in, and Dr. Joseph Avaram, he arranged a meeting with the president of Israel, Mr. Zalman Shazar. And at one point during the meeting that was at the president's residence, Mr. Armstrong stood up with an envelope in his hand and he gave it directly to the president of Israel. He gave it to the president of Israel. He didn't give it to Hebrew University. He gave it to the president of Israel because he believed that this excavation was all about Israel's history and the government should be involved. The government should be very supportive of it. And they were at the time. Now, Dr. Joseph Avaram discussed with me, once Mr. Shazar looked at the envelope and opened it up and saw the check, and Mr. Armstrong said, "Let's get started. Let's get started right away. Here's some money to start it." Then he passed along the check to Dr. Joseph Avaram, and he took care of it. And they could get these excavations started. And for the next 10 years, they would go on around the clock. Ambassador College, what Mr. Armstrong was the president of, he sent students over there, a lot of students, every summer to participate in the dig as volunteers. And then also the dig continued throughout the year, and Ambassador College would pay for half of that. Millions of dollars, really, to lead this huge excavation. But this is what we were touring. That's what we were touring with Melanie Phillips last Sunday, this excavation that brought to light a lot of the history of the Jews just south of the Temple Mount. Unfortunately, for Dr. Benjamin Mazar and Mr. Armstrong, I feel, by the time the excavation ended in 1976, they were only just discovering artifacts and buildings from the First Temple period. And that was, again, in the far reaches of this archaeological park. And in a way, I mean, it was kind of providential because 10 years later, Dr. Elot Mazar returned to this last little segment of the dig that they had just started to scrape the surface of and discover a gatehouse from the First Temple period. Then we would return there in 2009 to excavate, and then back in 2012 and 2013, and they're the Ophel excavations today. And it's not just a First Temple period gatehouse, but we have dating for that gatehouse now that brings it up to Solomon's time, or back to Solomon's time. King Solomon, under his reign, the great builder of Jerusalem before Herod, he built up this gate and he built this accompanying building. And I'm going to include some, well, in the article that Christopher Reams has written on Jerusalem that we'll talk about in the second segment, there is a video of just what's been uncovered to this time that you really need to go and watch. So as we walk through there, I just discuss some of the history of why I'm involved in archaeology here in Jerusalem and why Watch Jerusalem's involved in it as well, and Herbert W. Armstrong College. And she was kind of excited, or really excited, to see so much evidence of King Solomon. I mean, you can walk through the park and you touch the stones and King Solomon's men. But put that stone there. And maybe King Solomon wasn't the nicest man to the people that he ruled over and the workers that he ruled over, the workers putting that stone there. But it does go back and harken back to a glorious time in Israel's history that the Bible talks about for sure. But then so does the evidence. So do the stones. The stones talk about it as well. And you can see them if you go to this part of the Davidson Center Archaeological Park and see what's being uncovered in the Ophel excavations. Well, from there, we went down to the city of David a little bit lower. And I think that's something that people really do notice the first time they come to Jerusalem, is just how mountainous or hilly. There's lots of peaks and valleys here. I wouldn't call them mountains necessarily, but they are steep valleys and hills. And down from the Ophel area is this city of David, where the Palace of David was discovered by Dr. Elot Mazar back in 2005. And we talked about why she called this large stone structure the Palace of David with Melanie Phillips. And she seemed convinced. She thought that it was the most logical hypothesis. I tried to be as fair and balanced as I could. But when it comes to the truth, the truth is the truth. I don't feel like I need to do away or get so unbalanced as to speak about every single person that has a problem with the dating of this structure and whether it's King David's palace or not. But I was as fair as I could be, and she seemed to be convinced that, yeah, well, it just makes sense that it's King David's palace. And for any unbiased person, I believe, they would, if they have it explained to them logically, they would come away with that same conclusion. So after about 3.5 hours it was, we talked a little bit about her writing, and it was really interesting just to get her take, because as you watch her on the BBC or as she goes on at BBC Question Time, and she's mainly there because she's the controversial figure, and she'll no doubt get ratings, and that's why a lot of the papers like her, because she is such a controversial figure. But I got the sense that she doesn't really enjoy being a controversial figure. I think, really, she is a reluctant messenger, where she would much rather be writing something in literature, some literature, but instead, she's having to stand up for the truth. Because, really, as she sees it, there's not too many people doing it. But, I mean, she is a valiant woman who does give a very brave face to her arguments when she is on TV or when she is writing. It sounds very controversial, and it is, because a lot of the issues she discusses are so topical for today, especially when we're talking about Israel, because of the delegitimization of Israel that takes place around the world so often. She has to stand up and say, well, no, that's wrong. No, that's a lie. No, that's contrary to truth. And she said that the next time it comes up about the delegitimization of Israel, she's going to be using some of the photos she took and using some of the knowledge that she gained of what actually has been uncovered in Jerusalem from those Jewish and Israelite periods. Now, that's exciting, because that was my aim, to arm her with the facts so that she can shout the truth out as loud as possible. And that's what we aim to do with this program and our website. To talk about not fabricated history, just talk about the truth and show how the Bible and its history that it writes is accurate, especially of this time, especially involving Jerusalem. There is just so much history that has been uncovered already through archaeological excavations over the past 100 years in Jerusalem. There is just so much of it, and you're going to see that as well, as she did. You're going to see a lot of that history when we talk to Christopher Reams about a new article that was just posted earlier on Watch Jerusalem. It's all about Jerusalem and the history that's been uncovered to this point. So don't go away. We'll cut straight to that interview right after the break.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.fm, where history and prophecy come alive. Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG is produced by the Philadelphia Church of God. The Philadelphia Church of God also publishes the Philadelphia Trumpet. The Trumpet is a free monthly news magazine that analyzes world events. It offers a distinct perspective that compares current news to Bible prophecy. The Trumpet matches prophecy to the United States, Britain, and other nations. The Trumpet is published in Edmond, Oklahoma, alongside KPCG. More information is available at thetrumpet.com. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm here with Christopher Reams. Well, he's not here. He's actually over in our campus in the UK, Herbert W. Armstrong College campus in the UK.
G'day, Brent. It's good to be here.
Hey, Chris. You've just written an article for us on Watch Jerusalem, and it's a continuation of your series on the Bible's buried cities. Well, uncovering the Bible's buried cities, and you've done, I think, 4, 5, 6, or 7. I think this might be the seventh or eighth.
Number eight.
Great.
Yep.
So you detail the history of the different archaeological discoveries and how they have related to the history that the Bible covers for these cities, and you have concluded your series with Jerusalem. I think that's very fitting and probably something that's most necessary for our site to have Jerusalem and as part of this series. And what just blew me away reading it this morning was how much has been discovered in Jerusalem over the past 150 years that really does bring to light the Bible's history.
You're exactly right. This was by far my longest article in the series, and I really had trouble trying to cut it down. And what I've got there is really a stripped out analysis of just a small slice of finds that have been discovered in Jerusalem. So, yeah, like you say, there's a ton of stuff all through these cities in Israel, but especially in Jerusalem that I hardly got to many of the discoveries in total. I covered most of the big ones, but even then it was by far the longest article I've done.
Yeah, and I noticed as I was getting down to even Hezekiah's time that what I was discussing in the first part, just the Hezekiah bullet that was discovered in 2015, mm-hmm. and you gave that all of a sentence. One sentence the Hezekiah bullet gets. But then I looked at that in the context of all the history that you cover, and unless you want this article to be 30,000 words, you kind of have to give that type of treatment to some of the more individual finds. So I just appreciate the fact that you've written this up. I think people are going, it's going to probably take them, 15 minutes to read through it. But I've included a number of videos as well inside the article so that people can actually see what you're discussing in the article as well. And I would encourage people to go, and if you're listening to this, go back and read this article Uncovering the Bible's Buried Cities, Jerusalem by Christopher Eames. So let's just dig into this article right now. And where do you start the history of Jerusalem?
Okay, well, like with all of these articles, I start the history of Jerusalem with basically the earliest dated finds for Jerusalem, and then gradually progress, as readers may be familiar with, into a synthesis with the Bible record that the archaeological record actually shows. So with Jerusalem itself, we start out basically discussing the first evidence of settlement dating to about 3,500 BC, just very piecemeal kind of archaeological finds there. And yet it wasn't until the 1800s BC that you see the first city wall start to be set up around Jerusalem. Now, this is interesting for us because, as readers may be familiar with, the time of Abraham on the scene, living in the land of Canaan at the time. And after one of the battles he had fought in trying to rescue his kidnapped nephew Lot, this king of Salem comes to him and basically congratulates him on his victory, blesses him essentially. And this king of Salem is called Melchizedek. And he's also described in Genesis as being the high priest of God. And a very interesting king here, the king of Salem. And he dates to this time of Abraham, which is around the 1800s BC, maybe a little bit earlier than that. And that is exactly where this first city wall fits in Jerusalem. So I give a little speculation as to whether or not Melchizedek himself could have set up that very first established city wall there in Jerusalem. King of Salem, Salem is Jerusalem, essentially. It's the same thing, and we find that in the book of Psalms. David lists a number of names for the city, and he calls it, I believe it's City of David, Zion, Salem, Jerusalem, and so that kind of corroborates all of that.
That would have been good to know, because I had that exact question from Melanie Phillips last week as where I was standing on top of the City of David there, looking out over it, and I talked about how this kind of history about Genesis chapter 14 being the first time in the Bible where Jerusalem is mentioned as Salem. And then she was like, well, how in the world do you know that Salem is the same as Jerusalem? And I kind of said, well, Salem's in Jerusalem, so it's pretty logical that it's the same one. Yeah. But I didn't have that Psalm, Psalm 76 verse 2, I guess it is.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, you've got the link in the names there, but it is an interesting link in the Psalms. And some people in the past have deliberated as to whether Salem could be a different place. But looking at, like you say, Psalm 76, verse 2, you see that link there with Salem and Zion.
So after Genesis chapter 14, where that history of Abraham's discussed, when do we next hear of Jerusalem?
Okay, well, the next in my article that I go through, I cover briefly a little link with the Amarna letters. These were a trove of letters written by the Canaanite kings to the Pharaoh in Egypt, dating around the 14th century BC, and these were desperate letters to the Pharaoh of Egypt saying these people are invading, called the Habiru people. And I look at that interesting link briefly there between Habiru and Hebrew. These people are coming, conquering our lands. Now, for the correspondence by the king in Jerusalem, King Abdi Heba, I butchered that pronunciation, however they said it back then, but he was the mayor of Jerusalem, and he was writing correspondence to the Pharaoh about the Habiru coming in and saying, basically, these lands around me have been wiped out. Mine is the only land left. Please help me, Pharaoh, and save me from these Habiru. And I look at the parallel with that, with the Hebrews coming into Israel at that time, looking in Judges 1 and verse 1, 1 verse 8, it talks about the Hebrews coming in and most likely taking Jerusalem after Joshua is dead. So these conquests on Jerusalem itself seemed, from the biblical record, it's not absolutely directly clear, but it seems like the city was taken the first time after Joshua was dead, which could explain why all of these other lands were conquered, like Abdi Heba says, and why his was the only one left, essentially, at that time.
So, but by the time you get to David's time, he's got to reconquer the city, right? So something happened in the middle of the period of the Judges, right?
That's right, and it's covered right at the right in the book of Judges there, right at the start, that this city is conquered. It's basically burned, and yet the Israelites still allow the Jebusites to remain in the city. And you can see this having happened in a number of cities, actually, around Israel. I think one or two of my other city articles cover the same kind of phenomenon of the Israelites coming in. They're in this conquering spirit kind of at the time, and then they just kind of back off and let the inhabitants continue living in the city. And so that's what happens with this city in Jerusalem at the time called Jebus, the Jebusite city. Jebusites were the people that lived there. And so they essentially remained in the city throughout the time of the judges. I would assume that they were very comfortable there. They thought they were basically invincible there, because you can see that by the time David came on the scene, they would have been there 200 or 300 centuries. And they're taunting David.
200 or 300 years.
Yeah, right. That's right. 200 or 300 years, sorry. Yeah. And they're essentially taunting David, saying, you know what, if you want to come and take over the city, all we need are the blind and the lame and the disabled people to defend it. This is how strong of a city this is. And so by the time David comes on the scene, this really is a challenge to the man to take this city and to set it up as the capital of Israel. So he issues a challenge to his captains and whoever can lead a group of men into the city here, into Jebus, and take it. I'll make him king over all the captain, I'll make him captain over all the host. And so obviously Joab does that, and he goes through this tunnel that led into the city, some kind of a water conduit tunnel, and takes over the city that way. He gets in and takes the city from inside. And what has been found in Jerusalem lately under the excavations of Dr. Elat Mazar, she's found a tunnel that could be a candidate for what Joab himself used to get into the city. This was during her 2008 excavations, and this tunnel dates to the 10th century BC. So it was around the time when Joab would have been taking his men in to conquer the city of David. This tunnel, it's still blocked by debris, still needs more excavation, but it's at least 160 feet long. And it's believed it may have been a water passage, exactly what the Bible describes Joab used to conquer the city. And so we see now David taking over the city. The city's been conquered by the Jebusites and set up as the capital of Israel. And now we quickly ask the question, well, why take over this city as the capital?
That's good question. That's another one Melanie Phillips had. She said, so why did David want to move his capital to Jerusalem, this place in the middle of nowhere, kind of not right. Doesn't have any real natural resources. It's not on a major trade route. It's kind of in the hills and tucked away. It doesn't look like a place for a glorious capital. So what's your answer?
That's right. And it's a question I had as well, it was one that was answered actually by one of my Hebrew teachers in Israel on some Hebrew lessons I was taking there. Just put it really plainly. Essentially, David was king first over Judah, just the tribe of Judah. Obviously, God had anointed him to be the king over all Israel, but he was recognized as first the king of Judah for the first 7 years. Now, for the next 33 years, we know he was king for 40 years, he was accepted as king over Israel. And for the first 7 years in Judah, he was king in Hebron. Now, this is a city deep inside Judah's tribal territory. Jerusalem is right on the border territory. Basically, Judah and Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, cut into the city of Jerusalem. It basically separates the two tribes there. So this is essentially a signal to the other tribes that we're taking this new capital city and binding these tribes together. This isn't just about Judah, although Judah was about the most powerful tribe at the time. This is about bringing in all of Israel, setting up a city that is meaningful not just to Judah, but also bordering other tribes, that belongs to other tribes. So this is what David wanted to bring across.
So just going to the archaeology now from David's time, what do we have in Jerusalem? You talked about this tunnel, I guess, that Joab could have come up through to take the city. What else is there?
Well, basically, David started out with the city of Jebus. That was obviously what was remaining there from the Jebusites. And this was a smallish kind of enclosed city on the southern ridge of this mountainous region. And David essentially started out with that and then expanded the city a little further north. Now, what has been found there is a massive stepped structure, and called, obviously, the stepped stone structure. This is a massive kind of filler structure. It's really quite incredible to look at. A big sloped structure made out of stepped stones going all the way to the top. And then above the structure is a very wide set of walls that has been found, up to 16 feet wide, these walls, for a massive kind of structure here. And so what the chief archaeologist during these excavations of late, Dr. Elot Mazar, obviously Kathleen Kenyon before her and some others before her, what Dr. Mazar has uncovered is that this stepstone structure and the large structure atop that it supports must have been constructed by King David. It dates to King David's time. Underneath, elements of these structures were found pottery dating to before David's time, the Jebusites' time. So this must have been built by King David. Now, why by King David? What she has found is that there is a large gap in the bedrock between the southern section of the city and then moving further north. So her hypothesis is, and it's her theory, I guess I should say, is, and it seems to ring true, is that this city of Jebus was stopped from being expanded further north because of this massive bedrock divide in the mountainous range. And so David came along, he had the infrastructure, the support of a united Israel now, and so he was able to get these workmen and all these materials to fill in this massive gap in this mountainous bedrock with a huge sloped stepstone structure, and then to use that to support the new massive walled building atop of it. Now, the walled building atop of it is called the large stone structure. Again, walls 10 feet wide, 16 feet wide, massive structure. And maybe it sounds a little mundane to call it the large stone structure, but what Dr. Mazar has put forward is that this is the palace of King David. And now all of her explanations of this seem to fit the bill exactly as it's described in the Bible. The Bible talks about David dwelling high up in Jerusalem as his palace and actually coming down into the city of David, down into the fortified walls when a siege has come about. So we know he was living up high in the city of David. And this is basically the biggest structure dating to David's time that has been found. Absolutely massive structure, and one that would be an obvious candidate for David to have lived in the palace.
Yeah, I think that is just something that needs to be underscored, is just how big some of these walls are. And I remember back in 2006 when I was just an archaeology student working there on that site, just this is just a few months after Dr. Mazar had given it that designation, that name as King David's Palace, and she mm-hmm. had a whole host of people and archaeologists coming to look at the site. And there was big arguments back and forth. There was her nemesis, Israel Finkelstein, there coming in saying that it wasn't anything special. But then as the dig went on and as the years have gone by, more and more and more people are agreeing with her, with the dating at least, saying that, oh yeah, you did do a good job archaeologically. It might not be King David's Palace, but it is a massive structure built at the time that King David's Palace should have been built. So I find Dr. Mazar and even Melanie Phillips, as we were talking about this, I gave her the list of just reasons of why she called it King David's Palace, Dr. Mazar does, and she's like, well, it seems logical to me. And as to a fair-minded person, it definitely does seem that way.
Yeah, I'm actually somewhat confused by all of the debate and argument. Obviously, there should be healthy archaeological debate about finds, but to question so vehemently, like some of the archaeologists originally did, about this being the city, the palace of King David. This is the most massive structure there. It's the most glorious kind of structure in David's time period for the city of David. And why not? Wouldn't that be what a king would build for himself, newly established over all of Israel, a big, majestic kind of palace area for himself and for the prestige of Israel's united monarchy?
Well,
makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. But we could probably talk about this for another hour. But sure. your article does continue. So, where do we go after David?
Well, after David, we get into the time of Solomon. in the article. Again, just jumping through some more major finds. I don't go into all of them in this article, but we jump forward into the time of Solomon. And now following the biblical story and then seeing what we uncover on in Jerusalem itself, we understand that Jerusalem expands much further northward during Solomon's time, perhaps even doubles the size or more further northward up the mountainous ridge now that it's been filled in by David, now that the city can be linked by one powerful wall all the way around Jerusalem. And 1 Kings 9, I believe it is, talks about Solomon actually working on Jerusalem specifically, along with three other major cities. Those cities are all enumerated in the series. So if you haven't been reading through them, you've got some catching up to do. But in 1 Kings 9, we read about Solomon expanding the city of Jerusalem and working specifically on that wall. Now, part of that wall, that northern section of wall, has also been uncovered and dated by Dr. Mazar to the 10th century BC, to Solomon's time period, from the pottery. It is the most massive of wall stones. The stones, the individual stones themselves, maybe the section isn't quite as wide as David's palace, but the individual stones themselves for this regular wall, this regular defensive wall, are the most massive anywhere in Israel, largest hewn stones during the first temple period. And I've been there, and obviously you have as well, being there in Jerusalem and, like you say, being on the dig site there. These stones are enormous in size and numerous tons and tons of weight for this wall. And so
it really is something that people need to go and see. If you're in Jerusalem or Israel, and you don't even actually have to go into the archaeological park, you just go in the road, follow the road that's going around the old city and the Temple Mount to the east there by the Kidron Valley. And just as you turn the corner to go back up towards the Dung Gate, on your right, if you get out of your car and look over the railing, you're going to see massive, massive walls. And you might not be able to read the signs, but no, they are King Solomon period structures and walls.
It is incredible to see. I did that a few times myself over there in Jerusalem, just went out for a walk, didn't even go into the park, but just would stand outside and look at this wall. And it's almost a little disappointing because you're on the road there looking at this wall and you can see how it cuts in under the road, under a just ton of modern cement, just covering up this what would have been glorious building of Solomon's time period, and you kind of wish that they had taken the road round a different route.
Yeah, it's the greatest frustration of mine in Jerusalem archaeology is the fact that this important road that I don't know where you could move it right now is drives over the top of such substantial remains from Solomon's time. The very fact that the road doesn't fall into the Kidron Valley is because it's sitting on foundations that are 3,000 years old. One day, hopefully, we can excavate
Right.
So after King Solomon, you get into Hezekiah, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Jump over across into the late 8th century BC now. Can't cover all of the stuff in this time period, but we jump into Hezekiah's time period, and we see during his reign the invasion of Assyria into the southern kingdom of Judah. The northern kingdom had just been wiped out, and so we see this the invasion into the southern kingdom. We see the major city of Lachish conquered by the Assyrian king. That's discussed in another of my articles. And during this time period, the Assyrians are based in Lachish, and they're threatening Hezekiah, king of Jerusalem, saying that they're going to come up, they're going to destroy Jerusalem, your God can't defend you, we're going to come and take this city from you. And you can
That's what the Bible says. Is there artifacts, other artifacts to back up that?
There are. There's the reliefs, is what they're called, large stone engravings that have been found in this Assyrian king's palace in Nineveh that actually portray the capture of Lachish, directly what the Bible says there. And then if you look at the city of Lachish itself, you can see a large siege ramp that they used to get into that. Now, regarding Jerusalem, what Hezekiah himself did is to send tribute to the king of Assyria, and basically left it at that, prayed to God, asking for protection. The prophet Isaiah comes along, says that your prayers have been heard, the Assyrian king isn't going to enter, and the Bible describes how the Assyrian soldiers are basically all killed by an angel, and the king of Assyria just leaves it at that. He's not going to try and conquer the city. Now, what the Assyrian king has left behind archaeologically for us is a prism called the Sennacherib's prism, and this is dating to this time period, and the king boasts on this prism. I'll just read a little bit to you. As for Hezekiah, I shut him up like a caged bird in his royal city of Jerusalem. This isn't a biblical quote. This is an artifact that's been dug up out of the ground that says exactly what the Bible has been telling us. Hezekiah shut up like a caged bird in the royal city of Jerusalem. And the text goes on to mention how he received this tribute that the Bible describes from Hezekiah, but it leaves out completely any mention of invading Jerusalem. That's because he didn't. If he had invaded Jerusalem as the boastful king that he is, he would have boasted about it. He would have described it in this prism. He would probably have stone relief walls like he did for the more minor city of Lachish. So this proves exactly what the Bible has said. He didn't conquer Jerusalem. He just stopped short of caging up Hezekiah in the city. And also dating to this time period, due to the concern of the Assyrians coming in, the Bible describes Hezekiah taking counsel with his chief men about taking the watercourse around the Gihon there into the city of David. It was a little bit too exposed for them, and so they wanted to bring it deep into the city of David and protect it basically from any besieging power. And the Bible talks about this conduit that he brings into the city. Now, that has been found also archaeologically. Massive, massive, remarkable conduit stretching 530 meters long through the bedrock in Jerusalem. Now, it's even more incredible because this tunnel, dating to Hezekiah's time period, was dug out by the people building the tunnel back in his time period. It was dug from both ends. And so somehow they managed to dig together to meet in the middle, and the high end of it was only 30 centimeters higher than the low end of it, essentially making a 0.6% decline from the top end, bringing the water down to the low end of the city. An absolute engineering marvel. Scientists have only been able to speculate as to how this was possible. Still a lot of confusion about that.
So how do we know that this tunnel is from Hezekiah's time?
Well, one of the chief proofs of that is because of an inscription that was found inside this tunnel. It was actually overlooked originally due to it being a dark tunnel, and obviously you've had water going through it for a long time. It's quite a damp environment, and so it was somehow overlooked. It was set into one of the walls of this tunnel, but a boy ended up finding it. I believe it was an Arab boy that went through the tunnel and discovered it, and he alerted authorities as to it, and they chiseled it out, basically, and it's sitting in the Istanbul Museum, and that's a long text essentially talking about how it was built, about how the diggers were coming in from both ends and heard the guy on the up ahead of him chiseling towards him through the bedrock. And the script on this inscription dates to basically the script of Hezekiah's time period. There's analysts that look at script like this and can tell basically based on the nuances of the script as to what time
okay.
period.
Okay, so it's like the writing style, I guess, matches
exactly, yeah.
Well. Okay.
It does, yeah.
All right, so that's is that all for Hezekiah? I guess we have
that's
the Hezekiah Bulla,
yeah.
But there was a video on your article, so I'm going to let people watch that incredible 20-minute video detailing the discovery and the significance of that Bulla for themselves. And we might just take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll get through the second half of your article, The Bible's Buried Cities, Jerusalem. We'll take
Sounds
a break.
Good.
This is Trumpet Radio, 101.3, KPCG and kpcg.fm. The podcast of each show is available at thetrumpet.com, at kpcg.fm, and at iTunes. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. We're discussing an article Christopher Eames has written. We've got him on the line from the UK, and it's about Jerusalem, the Bible's buried city's Jerusalem, where he goes through the archaeological discoveries from that city and puts them against the biblical text and see how it adds up. And in the history we've been covering, we've gone through from Melchizedek's time all the way to Hezekiah, and now we're ready to move on with the second half of this article. Chris, what comes next?
All right, next up we've got the Kedef Hinnom amulets, and we'll go from there. These amulets were part of an interesting large trove of treasure that have been found really close to the old city of Jerusalem, the old ancient part of Jerusalem, just across a valley in the Valley of Hinnom, it's called, and there were some excavations going on there by Professor Gabriel Barke, and they found some cave kind of areas, didn't really find much there, and one of the boys on the excavation was just randomly tapping with a small pick, a makushan, as they call it over there, and accidentally went through the roof of a tomb. And so they peel back this tomb, and to their delight, they find thousands of objects inside this tomb. Absolutely incredible discovery. Now, the most significant of these objects were a couple of little metal scrolls made of 99% pure silver. Tiny, tiny, tiny little metal scrolls that have been bound up. And these were found a few decades ago. I forget exactly the year. Maybe it was the late 70s. Anyway, these scrolls were taken into the laboratory. It was asked, I believe, to a German university, do you want to try and unravel these for us so we can read it? And they looked at it, saw how tightly bound they were, and no, we don't want to touch that at all. You guys can do it yourselves if you want. So that's what the Israelis did. They very, very, very painstakingly unraveled these tightly wrapped silver scrolls to find text from the 7th century BC. That's when this grave area, this tomb area had dated, 7th century BC text directly paralleling scripture, notably from Numbers 6, verses 24 to 26, and a section of Deuteronomy 7, verse 9. And this is incredible, particularly because this is the earliest Bible script that has ever been found. Obviously, you've got the very significant Dead Sea Scrolls and all of that that go into proving biblical text and the ancientness of it. But here you've got the oldest ever sections of biblical script.
So this is like 700 years before the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Exactly, 7th century BC, oldest biblical text ever found. A section of it says, for example, may Yahweh bless you and keep you, cause his face to shine upon you and grant you peace. Sections like that from Numbers and Deuteronomy. Very significant discovery there. And moving forward in the article, basically we come next to the bulle, Gedaliah and Jehukal and Gemariah bulle. We haven't covered the Gemariah bulle too much, but again, like with the Hezekiah bulle, we'll let any listeners go and read about that themselves. There's a video there explaining those bulle princes, basically, during the time of King Zedekiah and the king before him for Gemariah, princes and a scribe that essentially were... One of them was for Jeremiah, and the other two, Gedaliah and Jehukal, were very much against him. Let's kill this guy. And we'll let you read into that more yourself. So after that, in the article, we discuss how Jerusalem was conquered around 586 BC by King Zedekiah. He tried to escape. His sons were executed. And you've got the end, basically, of the southern kingdom of Judah and of Jerusalem.
So you take it, you get to bring us a little bit outside that period as well, right?
That's right. Brings it basically right up to the last major discovery I cover is around the 7th century AD. So at this point in the story, we're looking at after Jerusalem's 586 destruction, Less than 50 years after that, the Babylonians were destroyed and the Medo-Persians take over. And then you start getting into the books of Nehemiah, Ezra, the Jews being sent back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple and the city wall. You've got the famous Nehemiah's wall around 445 BC that was built. And incredibly, that too has been found in Jerusalem, a wall dating to that Persian period time. Wall, actually, a little section of gate. Sorry, a tower that was found there, part of a large complex of the wall that was completed in only 52 days, discussed in Nehemiah 6. So a section of this wall dating to the Persian period was found. The appearance of this wall and small tower that it connects to exhibit a very rushed nature of construction, exactly what you would find dating to Nehemiah's time period.
He was very rushed.
He was very rushed. An incredible feat. 52 days for this wall completely around Jerusalem, replete with towers, gates, all of it. It was an amazing feat.
I was just thinking we're kind of running out of time here with this expose of Jerusalem, which makes sense since there's so much that's been discovered there. But this, the last find I'd like you to talk about, because I think most of our listeners would be a little bit unfamiliar with it, and it is extremely topical right now as well.
Okay, the last really major one that I discuss in this article is related to the temple. Now, there's been a lot of discussion, especially coming from between the Palestinians and Israelis saying, was there a temple on the Temple Mount? And the Israelis say, of course. A lot of Christian denominations are saying, of course, with the UN saying, trying to remove that link to the temple having been there, saying that, referring to it only by its Arab names for where the temple would have stood, saying basically, essentially, that the temple couldn't, that the temple wasn't there, and we can't offend anyone by saying that it was. Now, obviously, archaeological excavations are very restrictive in terms of up around the temple area. But what has been found is a couple of big stones, one complete stone and one partial stone, bearing text that belonged to the temple complex. And I'll read to you the text of this one inscription stone. It's called the Temple Warning Inscription. And it reads the following Greek text, dating to when the Second Temple stood, around the time of King Herod, just after King Herod, actually. He built the temple complex, and so this dates around that time period. And it reads, "No foreigner is to go beyond the balustrade and the plaza of the temple zone. Whoever is caught doing so will have himself to blame for his death, which will follow." Very dramatic text.
Yes, yeah, certainly is.
The historian Josephus writes about these text blocks, these stone blocks set up around the temple, warning people not to go inside, the Gentiles not to go inside. And so what we find is one big block bearing a full inscription and then one partial block. And so these stones are really, really convincing proof of the temple having stood there.
It definitely says that the temple was in existence. But where were these discovered, these inscriptions?
Well, one of these inscriptions was discovered in secondary use. I believe it was part of a Muslim home or Muslim school nearby, very close to the Temple Mount Ophel area. And I believe the other partial inscription was found just south of the Temple Mount. Currently, the partial inscription is still in Israel, and then the full Temple Mount text is in the Istanbul Museum in Turkey. But these were found in the general area of the Ophel Temple Mount area, and archaeologists have really only been able to excavate up to the southern portion of the Temple Mount wall. There was the big digs in the 60s and 70s, early 70s, I believe, that were able to excavate that area, but not inside the Temple Mount itself. So there's kind of piecemeal finds that have been coming up out of the nearby Ophel area that point to this, that point to this presence of the temple, like these Temple Mount warning inscription stones.
Great, great. Well, thank you, Chris, for bringing us that discovery. I hadn't really studied up too much on it. I noticed that you had had a back and forth with Istanbul Museum. You're doing a bit of research on these Temple Mount stones yourself right now. Yep. So maybe we'll look forward to a separate article in the future specifically about them. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to Christopher Eames. He has written an article on watchjerusalem.co.il entitled Uncovering the Bible's Buried Cities, Jerusalem, How Archaeological Discoveries from Israel's Capital City Correspond with Biblical History. Thanks very much for coming on the show with us today, Chris.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I said at the top of the show that we might be able to get to some feedback today, but it looks like we are out of time, so I'll have to save that for next time. Thank you very much to Christopher Eames for coming on the show, and thank you very much for listening to us. You have been listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy comes alive.